Hello, I'm Andrew Susskind, and I'm a psychotherapist and author based on the west side of Los Angeles since 1992, specializing in trauma and addictive compulsive behaviors. Welcome to my podcast, named after my recent book and workbook, It's Not About the Sex. Here we have direct and honest conversations related to compulsive sexual behavior and trauma, all from a sexual health perspective. Our intention is to offer fresh viewpoints and practical strategies toward establishing greater intimacy and a more deeply connected life. Let's begin. Hi, Sue.
Good morning, Andrew. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well.
Excellent. Excellent. So, as you know, the workbook, which came out in February, is going to be the focus of our episodes, meaning you and I, for the next 10 months.
Wow. And let me tell you, yesterday was the first day I got my hands on the workbook, and I love it.
So glad. Yeah, when I first put my hands on it, I said, Routledge Press did a damn good job. And, you know, you don't know until you actually feel it and see it. And, I saw obviously on the computer what it looked like, but then when you see it in print, it's a whole nother story. So I'm really pleased with how it came together. So thank you for saying that. And so the reason why I wanted to focus on the workbook for the next 10 months is that each month can be a focus on one chapter. And today we're going to be talking about the first chapter, which is called Reclaiming Resilience. And I really wanted to give our listeners a chance to take a closer look with us at what each chapter is truly about. And by the way, when people go through the workbook, it doesn't have to be from the start to the back, right? It can be in whatever order and in whatever way people choose to use it. So I just want to make that clear that it doesn't have to be linear.
Yeah, I like that. Sounds good. Cool.
So what I thought I would do is at the beginning of each chapter, I may have mentioned this before, at the beginning of each chapter, there's what we call a memoir snapshot. And really what it is a very short personal story to highlight what the chapter's about. So I'm going to go ahead and read the opening memoir snapshot.
Okay, great.
I was the baby of the family, the youngest of four boys. It was a complicated upbringing, to say the least. A family starving for love, but not a clue how to express it to one another. As a child, I easily fell into the role of being a heat-seeking missile, in search of love, attention, and validation wherever I could find it, from best friends, teachers, crossing guards, from anyone who provided more nourishment than what was available at home. This is the origin of my brokenheartedness, as well as my resilience. Did I go off the tracks as a young adult when I started to look for sex and romance in all the wrong places? Probably. But I knew from a young age that loving relationships were also going to be a sanctuary for me. At age 5, I was fortunate enough to have a grandmother who moved from Brooklyn to my hometown of Cherry Hill, New Jersey, just in time for me to enter kindergarten. We all need an unconditionally accepting person in our lives to remind us how lovable we truly are. I was extremely fortunate to have someone who showed up that way in my childhood, yet others may need to play catch-up later in life. My emotional resilience was highly disrupted by the constant turbulence at home, yet somehow I knew that my spirit was still alive, and my job was to reclaim it. I now believe that my compulsive sexual behavior was a misfired attempt to regulate my nervous system. And since the time I went to my first 12-step meeting in November of 1994, I've been on a road to restoring resilience, resourcefulness, and regulation.
You know, when you said that yesterday at your little book launch, I was like, oh, it connected the dots for me. But you also mentioned about the World Health Organization, mm-hmm. and it changing its definition, or was it changing it? I mean, or it was just like a new definition of sexual health.
They've actually been evolving
Okay.
their definition through the decades, but this is the most recent definition that I want to share with our folks who are listening. And I think I may have shared this somewhere along the way, but I like to set the tone for the workbook with the sexual health definition because that's the sort of the encompassing model or umbrella of what the workbook is all about. So what they say is sexual health is defined as a state of physical, emotional, mental, and social well-being in relation to sexuality. It is not merely the absence of disease, dysfunction, or infirmity. Sexual health requires a positive and respectful approach to sexuality and sexual relationships, as well as the possibility of having pleasurable and safe sexual experiences, free of coercion, discrimination, and violence. For sexual health to be attained and maintained, the sexual rights of all persons must be respected, protected, and fulfilled. So that's the definition, right? That was put together by a gathering of brilliant global clinicians. And so it really has evolved to the point where I think they're encompassing what it means to express oneself sexually safely and consensually and with pleasure and with expansiveness, et cetera, et cetera. So I just wanted to share that definition just to set the tone today.
We started off by talking about the title of this is the chapter, right? Reclaiming resilience. Okay.
Right.
And so what exactly is sexual resilience?
It's a great question because I'm not even sure I specified this in the workbook, but I was thinking about resilience in terms of emotional resilience, sexual resilience, nervous system resilience. I mean, it goes on and on, right? But resilience is really about the coping skills and the ways of transcending difficult and sometimes traumatic experiences. Right. So the resilience within us helps us move forward after something difficult happens. And so, if we're talking about compulsive sexual behavior, we're talking about difficult and challenging and sometimes traumatic experiences that require someone in recovery, as I call it, someone in healing, to determine for themselves that they want to live a different life. And in this case, how do they live a different life within their sexual expression, their sexual identity? And so I really see sexual resilience as a interwoven part of the workbook, right? How do we reclaim? How do we establish? How do we develop new visions, et cetera, for what we can incorporate, right? And we're not just talking about sex, right? And we're talking about sex and love and intimacy and affection and connection and belonging and all of those good things that sometimes are solo, right? Sometimes it's about things like masturbation and how we choose to express ourselves individually, and sometimes it's relationally, right? With other people. And so it doesn't matter what we're talking about in terms of sexual behavior, sexual choices, but can we find healthier, more satisfying ways of expressing ourselves beyond the compulsive sex?
So that's interesting because when I think of resilience, I think of kind of like an elastic, like snapping back to something before. But what I hear you saying is almost like snapping back, but erasing everything, like or addressing the trauma or whatever had happened and creating something new.
Right. It's both, right? And I think that's a good way of putting it, that it's partially about healing the past and finding ways of learning to live with it. It never goes away, right? It's not about getting over it. It's about learning to live with it. And what is our sexual vision? What is it that would really be fun and pleasurable and liberating and expansive and playful and all that good stuff that sex is really supposed to be about in theory, right? A lot of us, it doesn't matter if we're in recovery or not, but finding that more Broadway that broad, right, exactly, very New York. Looking at it from a broader perspective is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I like that, opening the lens up and finding that joy. Yeah. All right. Well, what are your antidotes for brokenheartedness? Like, what has helped you persevere through the toughest times?
Sure. So from a personal perspective, right? I'm not speaking for everyone here, but for me, it's always been about finding the love and the unconditional acceptance, like I mentioned with my grandmother in the opening, who in ways that were just so palpable and that I was able to hold on to. And even through everything that I've been through in my life, my grandmother has always been in my heart. She just got in there at an early age, and I just was so lucky to have her set a tone for love in my life, right? So when I think about the antidotes to brokenheartedness, they often show up through intimacy, through deeper connection or deeper contact. And what I call emotionally reliable or emotionally dependable relationships.
Nice. So we did speak a little bit earlier about different types of resilience. Can you dive deeper into what emotional resilience is?
I can do that, Sue. Absolutely.
This is my favorite topic.
It's interesting because in the book, the original book, it's not about the sex. I actually wrote more about emotional sobriety in chapter one. And I think emotional sobriety is so valuable, but something clicked for me when I wrote the workbook, which shifted my thinking a little bit away from the term emotional sobriety, which has its place for sure, and more towards emotional resilience. So, like I said before, it's really the ability to adapt to stressful or sometimes unexpected situations and cope better, hopefully, with life's up and downs, right? And so that's kind of the broad definition, I would have to say, of emotional resilience. Now, I kind of went to town with this idea because I thought, what the heck, I'll just talk about emotional resilience in the words that came to me in my book. And this is, as everybody knows, I'm not a researcher, I'm not an academic. This is all from experiential work, mostly in my office, but really absorbing 30 years of 12-step was part of it. And then my own kind of synthesis of all of that. So for me, emotional resilience is about the capacity to experience the fullness of life. It's about, and I love the alliteration here, a resilient, resourceful, regulated state of well-being, right?
Ah, the
A
four R's.
resilient, exactly. I'll get there. And when you feel most like yourself, when you feel most comfortable in your skin. So to me, those are like the signposts of emotional resilience. Now, I also came up with
The four R's.
the four R's.
This is
I'm
R.
exactly. You can growl the four R's. It's funny because some reason I think I like alliteration because I remember things better
Oh, yeah.
when I come up with things like this. So the four R's are four very simple reminders about what can promote emotional resilience. Okay. So the four R's go like this: relaxation, regulation, responsiveness, and relating. Okay. So what I say about the four R's is I think important in the sense that again, this is not meant to be rocket science. This is meant to be things that hopefully we can all grab onto and take with us, that it can be portable wherever we go. So for instance, when I'm talking about relaxation, I'm really talking about the art of relaxing, right? I'm talking about when We physiologically slow down, right? So in our culture, we're not really taught how to relax that often. We have to find it, whether it be in a yoga class, whether it be in a guided meditation, whether it be in mindful techniques, right? So that's really what I'm talking about. Relaxation is the physiological changes. Number two, regulation, which I talk mostly about when I'm talking about the nervous system, is when we're feeling in that zone where we're not upregulated, we're not downregulated, we're just in that place, kind of like the Goldilocks effect, right? We're feeling most calm and peaceful and grounded. Responsiveness, I always say that our goal in life is to respond rather than react, right? Oftentimes, when we have an activating stressor or just anything that happens in our lives, we go right to reactivity, and that's very human. But what I'm really suggesting is, can we take a pause? Can we take that moment to breathe, literally, to breathe, to sometimes bite our tongue so that we don't say anything too quickly, to give ourselves that moment of cognitively saying, can I wait? Why am I talking? Wait. And so there's lots of different ways to respond and to slow down, but it's all about pausing, right? Responsiveness is all about the pause.
And do you think that just takes practice?
For sure.
Right? Like, I mean, I feel like I can do that most of the time, but there are still times, maybe like in traffic or, when there's like a quick change in events where I'm like, oh, this is an opportunity to not respond and, try to regulate, try to relax in the moment. It brings the awareness more like it's a heightened awareness of like, let's try to work on this.
Right.
Do you think like working out on it in different scenarios kind of is cumulative?
Yeah, I think without a doubt, all of this is about a practice. And like we say in program, it's progress, not perfection. And it's really about giving yourself a lot of compassion for just giving it the old college try, right? And not having to, shame yourself for reacting, because we all react at different times in different ways, but just slowing it down just little by little by little. And I couldn't agree with you more. It's a practice. It's something that gets learned. It's because the well-worn path is really about reacting. That's what we generally do.
Right. I think that's biologically programmed that
For
way.
sure.
We live in
Yeah,
fear.
it's fight flight kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
But we're just putting it out there like, oh, we have an option. There's something in between that we can do. I'm big biting. I'm into tongue biting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, biting sometimes too, but tongue biting my tongue literally is a way for me to remind myself to wait. Sometimes I'll be activated and I want to react, and then I bite my tongue. Or I ground myself. I just take a few breaths and I notice my body, my weight, wherever I am. So that's responding or responsiveness. The last thing is relating, and it's really about cultivating connectedness. Like I said before, deeper connection really is about connecting to oneself, right? Mind, body, and spirit. It's connecting to trusted others and really leaning into the love and making outreach calls or asking for support from others. It's hard to ask for help sometimes. So connecting to trusted others who are there in our lives and connecting to a power greater than ourselves. So that could be anything. It could be God or higher power. It could be nature. It could be a pet. Anything that's bigger than oneself. So that's my formula for relating and connection.
Those are great tools to bring into your coping toolbox, I think.
I agree.
But
Yeah,
practice is important. I mean, even just Being mindful in certain moments will help exercise that as well and create new neural pathways. I'll say a lot of times, find mindfulness within the mundane, like washing your dishes or filling or unfilling your dishwasher. Be there, be present in that action, because it's just an exercise for your brain. Instead of it going off and all, what am I doing next? What time is
Right.
this? Blah, 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 blah. Give yourself the moment to be just in that small little window,
Yeah.
and as you exercise that, it'll become easier to be more present and be more mindful. And all these things, I think, kind of just work with each other very well.
No, that's beautiful, Sue, because unless we're truly in the present tense, we actually can't do any of these things, really. My favorite way of regulating or coming into the present tense is by petting my dog, actually. And not just going through the motions, but like really noticing, like, oh, that his fur is so soft, and his tongue is so rough, and
It's almost
his
elementary stuff, but
yes.
it's being present and
Yeah.
yeah, it's a gift.
Yeah. I mean, Peter Levine calls it the felt sense, and really talks about how we can experience our surroundings. And in my very, very first somatic experiencing weekend, he talked about this idea of every morning when you're in the shower, just notice what it's like to have the water touch our body. And hopefully we can feel that water on our body. There may be some people who can't actually, but that's the felt sense. It's just to pay attention to the sensory experience, and then comes all the rest for sure.
Yeah, it's really being heightened awareness and response. I love all of this stuff. I'm
Yeah.
working on it. I'm getting there.
Me too.
You spoke about shame a little bit. What is shame resilience? And talk a little bit about how group therapy helps build shame resilience.
Sure. I talk about shame in chapter two, actually, but I wanted to mention this only because we are talking about emotional resilience. So we're talking about all the different kinds of emotional experiences that either require resilience or get bolstered by resilience. And I think it may have been talked about before Brené Brown, but I'm just going to go with what Brené Brown taught us. I mean, she talked about shame resilience as an opportunity to pay attention to when shame as an emotion can actually be an opportunity for growing and learning, right? So she talks about how do you name the shame? How do you identify it? How do you tell your story behind the shame? How do you identify how shame has impacted you? And then shame resilience is often about how do you put yourself in situations and experiences and in relationship where the shame gets diminished. So I wanted to use the example of group therapy since I'm in the group therapy room a lot and love it. And what I see all the time is that Brené, I want to call her Brené without even naming her last name, because I don't know how many Brenés there are out there, especially famous ones, right? But she talked about how shame is given to us by others and shame is healed through others, right? Shame is given to us by others and shame is healed through others. And what I believe is that every person who comes into my group therapy rooms has been shamed in their life, right? We're human. So they come in with this shame history, the shame template. And it's invisible, of course. We don't know when we meet one another. But then they start to share in group their shame stories little by little. It might come out in just a little word or two, or it might come out in a longer story about something that happened. But either way, they start to talk about it. And by talking about it, they're witnessed by others, and oftentimes They're joined by others, where others in the group will say, "Wow, I can really relate to that. That sounds so similar to what I went through." Right? So automatically, the person who shared originally says, "I don't feel so alone." They might even say, "I feel closer to you because we have that in common." Right? So that's where I think group therapy is truly reparative, because I have groups of generally 7 or 8 people, and these are ongoing, long-term, weekly groups. So they'd really get to know each other. And in the group room and in the group experience, everybody shares their shame story at one time or another. And what I always say about shame is it's really just another emotion. It's often sticky and often stubborn, but it's going to move by eventually. And that's really what I'm looking for, is for that movement. If somebody is saying the same thing over and over again about that shame story, we have another opportunity to work on that in some other way. But generally, it does diminish, and it's so satisfying for me to see that happen.
Carrying shame is it's a whole body experience. I think it affects every part of you. It's like a heavy burden to carry for a long time. So to watch it diminish must be very rewarding and helping someone blossom out of that.
Yeah, and as you're talking, what I was thinking about, yes, it is burdensome for sure, and it does eventually, not all the time, but eventually in group, it lightens, right? It gets a little lighter over time. But also, I think it's almost taboo in our culture to be talking openly about shame, right? Shame seems to be this
Very
thing that goes
personal.
underground.
Right.
And I really try and normalize it and say, look, this is part of being human. You can share as much or as little as you choose today. We have plenty of time. You can share next week, next month, next year, whatever works best for you. But we're all here open to understanding more about what that means to you, and really emotionally and physically on a nervous system level. How it lives inside of you, because we don't want it to be living there for too long.
What happens? Do you think it just stops people from evolving or learning about themselves if they can't diminish it?
It's a great question. I think it becomes a broken record sometimes, because the neural pathways are so used to it. It's so familiar, and it becomes such a habit. Sometimes I think about the repetition compulsion that Freud used to talk about, that we do things over and over until we're finished, right? And sometimes it takes a long, long time, and sometimes it feels, to me anyway, like, wow, is this ever going to lift? Sometimes people leave group before they get to experience those kinds of benefits. But when somebody hangs in there and really is willing to keep coming back and to learn about themselves and help others be there with them, that's when, and program again, I go back to this, that's when the miracles happen, right? That's when the reparative healing experience really takes shape.
I got this image of lifting the needle off of a record. I don't know how many people would be able to get that image, but I think they're coming back. But yeah, when that record is just spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning, if you
Right.
could have the courage and the know-how and learn how to lift that needle,
Yes.
you'll stop that annoying sound, you know?
Right. And on a record or an album or whatever we're talking about, there's grooves, right? And those are just like the grooves of the pathways in our brain. So sometimes we just have to go around and listen to that song over and over and over. And then we're like, oh, I don't really care for that song too much anymore. right?
Yeah,
Eventually.
exactly. Yeah,
Yeah.
I love this analogy.
Yeah, me too. That's great.
Lifting the needle. That's
Especially since
the
LPs were so so much a part of our childhood.
Well, it's been a great time chatting with you about resilience, and that I always like come up with images. I think of like a duck with the water, rolling off the back of a duck, like having resilience and
For sure.
being strong through all of it. But
Yeah, no, this is fun. I'm really looking forward to focusing on the 9 other chapters as well
I'll try
this
not to look
year.
ahead.
No. Just stay with 1 chapter at a time, 1 day at a time.
Okay, got it. Thanks, Andrew.
You're welcome. Take care, Sue. Thanks for listening today. It was so wonderful sharing the time with my colleague and friend, Sue Merlino, and discussing this really significant topic of emotional resilience. If you're so inclined, please give us a 5-star rating and be sure to subscribe and share my podcast with those who may benefit. I look forward to you joining us the next time, and don't forget to stay connected.